Most of you weren't aware or conscious of energy questions then, but those of us who are old-timers can remember the first nuclear power plant being built near Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania someplace, and the hope and optimism which surrounded the nuclear option was high and great. Today, that optimism is certainly muted, if not altogether gone. Before we get into some of the pros and cons of nuclear, a word about nuclear power scientifically. I'm not going to go into great detail. On your outline, you'll notice that I've listed three forms of nuclear power: conventional, breeder, and fusion. The first two, conventional and breeder, are what is called fission nuclear power. Basically, fission is the splitting of atoms, particularly atoms with a high atomic number, that is a heavy atomic weight, particularly uranium. You've all heard of uranium, but uranium can be bombarded. Certain forms of uranium, it comes in many different forms, can be bombarded, and in the process of splitting up of this large atom, mass is lost, and according to Einstein's famous equation E=mc², the loss of mass times the speed of light squared is the amount of energy produced. So for a very small loss of mass, you get gigantic and tremendous amount of energy. The type that's used in conventional reactors today is U-235, which is a fairly rare form of uranium. Only 1% of the uranium found is found in that particular isotope. One of the products of this splitting of the U-235 atom is plutonium, but it only comes in small quantities. What happens with the U-235 is that it's mined like any other mineral, and then it's fabricated into rods, which are then placed in a what's called a core, and by moving that core up and down, that is, exposing more of the rods, you can regulate the amount of heat that is given off by those rods. The more you expose of the core, the rods, they interact with each other, causing a chain reaction, because in the splitting of an atom, more neutrons are given off, and it's the bombardment of neutrons against this U-235 atom which splits it. And each time one of these splits, it gives off between 2 and 3 more neutrons. So a chain reaction is started. Each one gives off more neutrons, which splits another U-235 atom. But if you expose more of the rods of the fabricated fuel, you'll get more of a reaction. Of course, if you expose U-235 and bombard it with neutrons and a critical mass, you get an atomic bomb. A fission bomb is the atomic bomb which was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In terms of conventional nuclear power, the rods are so constructed that you can never get that critical mass to produce a bomb. So the possibility of having a nuclear explosion of a type of a bomb in a nuclear plant is theoretically impossible. It may be actually possible, I guess, but theoretically that's not the safety problem with conventional nuclear power. In the process of the splitting of the atom, radiation is given off, and it comes in three kinds: alpha, which are very large particles and don't penetrate too far, but when they do, if they get inside you, they're extremely destructive. The other two forms are beta and gamma, less destructive, but still capable of causing considerable damage if encountered in significant number of forms. Gamma radiation, by the way, is also what you get in x-rays when you get your teeth x-rayed and so forth. I'm not going to go into the types of reactors they have in the conventional, but basically the conventional that we use now is the splitting of the U-235 atom with a small residue of plutonium. I'm mentioning this small residue of plutonium because it becomes very important, because it is the stuff out of which bombs are made. The second form on your outline is the breeder reactor. That is, again, one which has at one point or another been seen as the great hope. The breeder reactor actually produces fuel as it's consuming fuel. It starts out with the isotope of uranium called U-238, which is 99% of the uranium found in the natural state. And in the process of splitting of U-238, a large amount of plutonium is produced, and plutonium in turn as a fuel. So you actually produce fuel in the process of using up fuel with this breeder reactor. Now, the problems with the breeder reactor are many. One is the huge amount of plutonium, the stuff a bomb that's produced. Plutonium also has a half-life of 24,000 years. Half-life is the amount of time it takes for half of it to decay. So there's half of the radioactivity of plutonium left after 24,000 years.
Solve our energy problem.
Yes. Plutonium is also, the breeder reactor is still in the experimental stage. It's very expensive and very dirty in terms of radiation. But the breeder reactor is the second type of the fission reactors. Turning to, those are the two basic designs that are now considered for fission. Of course, the conventional fission reactor, which comes in various forms itself, is already in widespread use. I'll give you some statistics on that in a minute. The third form is fusion power. Fusion is the hydrogen bomb as opposed to the atomic bomb. And the fusion reaction occurs with the fusing together rather than the splitting apart, the fusing together of two heavy hydrogen atoms. Most hydrogen atoms have one proton and one neutron. Heavy hydrogen, called deuterium, has two protons and one neutron. I think that's what it is. I'm not sure of the protons and neutrons, but it has one extra proton or neutron. And deuterium is found as about, I think, 3, 4, 5% of the hydrogen, forms of hydrogen, come in that isotope. And it's readily available in the ocean, a very plentiful supply of the fuel. And what basically happens is, under great temperatures, two of these heavy hydrogen atoms are fused together. And in this process of fusion, again, mass is lost, according to the equation E equal mc squared. The catch with the fusion reaction, the problem that there is now being researched, is how to contain the tremendous temperatures which recur in this reaction. To get a hydrogen bomb to go off, what was used was to detonate an atomic bomb first to produce the temperatures which could produce the chain reaction, fusion reaction, and the hydrogen bomb. Actually, it literally forced, an atom bomb was used to force the deuterium together under a high enough temperature to produce a chain reaction and an explosion. The advantages of the fusion reaction is that the supply of fuel is, while not unlimited, certainly in vast quantities in the ocean water. Uranium, by the way, which is the basis of the fission reaction, is depletable, and indeed forms of U-235, which are now being used, can be used up fairly rapidly. That's why the emphasis on the breeder and fusion are so great. The advantages also are very low radiation. There is some radiation associated with the fusion reaction, but it's not nearly as severe as with the fission. The problems is this temperature. Some experimentations have been going on, particularly at Princeton and MIT, using two designs to attempt to contain this 100 million degrees centigrade, by the way, is the temperature. That's hotter than the sun, is the temperature you need to contain. And of course, there's no physical body that can withstand that kind of temperature, so they're experimenting in ways which I don't quite understand with first of all, laser beams, but second, with magnetic fields. If the magnetic field is strong enough, it will contain the particles which are charged and keep them within this magnetic field, hence contain the reaction. How that works is a little bit beyond my understanding, but there has been some attempt. In fact, they have, with the magnetic field at Princeton, had some success now in actually achieving the temperatures that are necessary there at that stage. And certainly the fusion reaction and fusion power will not be in your electrical system anytime in the near future. Some people are projecting the year 2000, some many beyond, and some people think we'll never get it. If we do or do not get it, it's going to be probably expensive. Okay. Well, all I can say in response is that what scientists I read on this, there is a widely varying opinions as to the feasibility of this and questions like that.
That's just one aspect that people normally don't look at. Mm-hmm. You need chromium and lithium in the reactor, and those are just in short supply.
Yeah. Well, those are certainly other considerations. Okay, so some quick facts about nuclear power. There are 204 commercial reactors in the world today, 71 of them in the United States. Nuclear provides 9% of our electrical capacity. 9% of the capacity, and it's something like 12% of the total electricity is provided. Now, the difference between capacity and total amount is that nuclear reactors tend to run more often than some of the other forms of energy for peak loads and things like that. So it actually provides more than the capacity percentage. In the period 1975 to 79, less than half a dozen new reactors were ordered, and there were 20 cancellations. In fact, today, the number of new reactors being built, ordered rather, is almost non-existent. The nuclear industry is on severely bad times for various reasons, one of which is the extremely high cost. We have to remember when we're talking about nuclear power that we're not just talking about a reactor itself. We're talking about a mining process, an enrichment process. Once you mine the materials and dump the tailings, by the way, you have to have an enrichment process to get the fuel in sufficient in quantities which are concentrated. Then the fabrication of the rods, then the electricity, the building of these large plants, the electricity generation itself. Then the fuel gets reprocessed so that it can be reused. Then there's problems of waste management. And in all these stages of nuclear power, there's a requirement for transportation. All except the mining process, and even that to a certain degree, involve radioactive materials. Each of these stages are subject to theft and sabotage, and all stages are costly. The advantages of nuclear on your sheet is that in certain forms it's almost a renewable fuel, particularly in form of fusion. Conventional nuclear is not renewable, but it's certainly as an energy source, has great potential in terms of supply. Some forms of it, and you may laugh at this, relative to other forms, it's non-polluting. Now, if you talk about radiation and the escape of radiation, you're in a different ballpark. But in terms of a nuclear power plant, you can actually sit on the fence around a nuclear power plant and experience less radiation than sitting on the fence around a coal-fired plant. There's, of course, radiation that comes from coal-fired plants, but the amount of radiation which you experience in the vicinity is in fact less. And it produces, of course, no exhaust like coal or oil in its burning. Now, the problems with nuclear, and they're mammoth. First of all, and I'll just quickly go through these, radiation causes cancer in large amounts. Of course, we're talking about radiation in terms of an event like Three Mile Island. The real danger is this problem of core meltdown, which can occur. And at Three Mile Island, the rods were exposed at too high a temperature. They couldn't shut the rods down for some reason, and the temperature went very high. What they're afraid of is that not an explosion, but temperatures getting so high in the core that the core literally melts down into the earth, because it will melt anything that it comes in contact. And with that would come the great exposure of radioactivity. So radiation is the main problem resulting from a nuclear accident. Another problem with radiation is the radioactive waste. The materials that come from these nuclear reactors are now stowed in pools right at the reactor in drums, in kind of swimming pools, so to speak. We have not yet devised long-range storage problems, and some of the radioactive material has half-lives of 24,000 years. And that's one of the big stickers in this thing. Most scientists believe that the problem of storage of radioactive waste is soluble, that is, solvable. Unfortunately, nobody wants it in their backyard. The three places where it is stored now, primarily the biggest dump site is within 150 miles of us right here at Hanford. Are you all familiar with Hanford in Washington here?
No.
Hanford is a big nuclear complex down here near the Tri-Cities. Hanford, Kennewick, Pasco are the Tri-Cities. And it's a big reservation out in the desert. And there are now two nuclear power plants there, and the project of about three more going to be a huge nuclear reservation, and it is also the primary storage site of nuclear waste, particularly low-level ones now.
They store it in drums?
They store it in drums in various areas. Again, the storage is not adequate there, and there is some problem with rusting drums. Mm-hmm. The other place is in Barnwell, South Carolina, and a place in Nevada. Now, most of those are storage sites for low-level nuclear waste, which come from medical processes, for example, not from nuclear power plants. Again, the nuclear power plant waste is being stored in drums on location at the plants until such times as the long-range process can be solved. Now, the solution to the long-range process, some of them are ingenious, and one is to put the waste in titanium drums and store them in relatively stable rock formations. There's a lot of people who complain that they still leak and get into the water supply. There's a raging debate whether, in fact, that's a safe way to store waste. I am not a scientist to tell you whether or not storing them in concrete or granite formations, which are relatively stable, is safe or not. Another suggestion, which seems to me has some merit, though probably very expensive, is again to encase these wastes in titanium casings and drop them in the rift in the North Pacific. Most of you perhaps are familiar with this theory of plate tectonics, where the crust of the Earth is these moving plates, and where they move, where they crash together, you can have them going like this together, in which case there's often locking and earthquakes, San Andreas Fault in California, or in most cases a diving under. Cascades are a product of the diving under of the Pacific plate as the North America plate rides over the top of it. Now there's a fairly stable area where not much volcanic activity, someplace in the North Pacific, up around Alaska. And the theory is to drop these drums down where this diving under is occurring, and the drums will actually be down into the center of the Earth, where they'll become part of the molten material down there, and the and I think there's even radioactivity down there in that molten material. I'm not sure of that.
You fold it in like cake.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it would melt down there under with the rest of the molten material, and effectively you would deal with it. Again, I'm not sure if that's a Rube Goldberg device or one that has possibilities, but I have done some reading on this, and some scientists feel that that problem is potentially solvable. Right now, it is not solved. And the problem in places like Hanford is that nobody wants their state to be the nuclear waste. In fact, the state of Washington just passed a piece of legislation at this last election saying that we would not be the dumping site.
The idea of putting up along subduction zones is, in a sense, not real feasible. It's not like you place it here and 10 years later it's going to be sucked into the earth. I mean, the rates there are very slow. And we're talking on the order of half-lives. I mean, it's just going to be sitting on the ground throughout most of its radioactive activity before it gets.
Well, over 24,000 years, it might get sucked in there.
Yeah, but still the rates are so slow that it's just going to be sitting there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I've heard people talk about geology and waste disposal, that's usually not talked about. One that is encasing the radioactive material in glass and then glass and coolant and then in the titanium drums. And there's one idea of putting them in containers that are shaped like bullets, and they dump them off into the ocean. Along on these plates, there are vast areas where they're just incredibly stable. There's no volcanic activity or anything, and over eons, millions and millions of years, you've had clay that has accumulated several hundred feet thick, and what they plan on doing is shaping these into bullets and letting them drop, and the velocity is such that they'll sink, I'm not sure how far, into this clay, and the clay oozes enough that it seals itself up, and that would, there are, for all practical purposes, not connecting with the seawater, so there's no pollution there.
How far out in the ocean are these clays?
They would be like halfway between San Francisco and Hawaii, that kind of area. It's all over the ocean, but that's kind of the one area.
That would be beach. Okay, drop it, sir.
there is a there's one other solution that over the years I've heard, and I haven't heard it recently, because it has obvious drawbacks, but to put these wastes on the end of a rocket and fire them into the sun, the problem with that is if you have rocket failure, you may well have a mess on your hands.
I might add, most of the problems with nuclear wastes are my problems with water. One problem is, you know, how stable is this formation? And the next one is, you know, how communicative is it with the groundwater system? That's the problem with the deep granite formations, the very stable Shield and Canada and so on. They're not sure the fracture system in the rock, how readily groundwater is circulated down there and circulated out.
There is a vast difference of opinion again. If you investigate this area, scientists can be lined up on both sides of this. Okay, the third drawback is cost. Research, development, the capital cost of these plants, of just building these plants, is tremendous. I was talking to one power company executive who said that he would not recommend nuclear power to his board of directors as an option, not because he was against nuclear power, but basically because it was a poor investment. And the reason why there have been so few orders in the last few years is basically because of cost, not because the power companies have any qualms about nuclear power per se. The fourth is the supply of energy. Uranium supply in conventional is depletable. That I've mentioned before. Reactor safety itself, a word. There have been several studies done on reactor safety, and perhaps the most famous was a 1972 report called the Rasmussen Report, which said that you could expect a core meltdown every 17,000 reactor years. There's 200 reactors going now, and each of them operating a year. That's 200 reactor years per year. So you would take 1,000 reactor years would be 5 years' time. So 5 times 17, you could expect a major meltdown 5 times 17 years. What's 5 times 17? You whizzes.
85.
Every 85 years, you could expect a major core meltdown. What kind of losses would you expect from this? Well, one report in 64 estimated 27,000 people could be killed in the worst possible accident. Again, these figures are very disputed by people in the business. But in any case, the big danger from a core meltdown is the radioactivity, that exposure that would occur alongside of it. Another drawback is the question of weapons proliferation. We've talked about that. If plutonium is a byproduct and many countries are now desiring nuclear power plants, then the availability of plutonium in those countries at least provides the potential for the making of bombs. And there's no way that you can get around this, though many people claim that you could make bombs with or without a reactor in your country if you had the determination to do it. Nuclear terrorism, I don't know, what size do you think a nuclear, just ask a question here, what size do you think the smallest bomb in the American, atomic bomb in the American arsenal is? What size do you think it is? Anyone take a guess?
Size.
Size of a big double wide GE refrigerator. That's the smallest one.
Lunch bucket.
6 inches. And with a sophisticated bomb can be made with only 4.5 pounds of plutonium. A less sophisticated bomb can be made with about 9 pounds of plutonium, or 25 pounds of U-235, or 10 pounds of U-233. It doesn't take much of this stuff if you have the capability to make a bomb. And you've all heard of that story about the MIT student who using declassified materials was able to design a credible bomb, which then the government classified immediately within 5 weeks using materials that were readily available in the library. That's kind of scary, and I don't want to mean to give you a kind of scare tactic here, but one of these things in a suitcase in a downtown area of a city would cause tremendous destruction. We're messing around with some pretty nasty materials when we're messing around with nuclear. But unfortunately, it's like Pandora's box. It's already there, and trying to box that stuff again once it's loose is not so easy. Yes, Lois?
I just kind of wondered if you have an idea of how much destruction, like in square miles, a bomb the size of a lunch box does.
I don't know.
Are you talking about destroying a portion of the city, or?
Oh, I would suspect that a bomb that size would not have a huge destructive capability. I know when I was in the Navy, we had nuclear weapons on board the ship, and they were fairly small and localized in their use. But well, I would imagine it could decimate a half square mile or a square mile of the city fairly easily. I mean, that's a mess. If you take a city like New York, where you have 250,000 people living in a square mile in some places, you could...
Mm-hmm.
Incredible. Okay, two quick other... the social implications, we've tried to talk about that there are social, structural implications to technologies. And one of the social implications, it seems to me, of nuclear is that it requires absolute stability in a society for its management. If you've got half-lives of 24,000 years and nuclear reactors with potential destructive capacity in just in terms of a quarter, you have to have a society that is stable or the next thing to stability. Now that sounds nice because stability usually means peace, but often there's stability without justice, and it could well mean a police state in terms of the structure of a society. The society may decide that the protection of these power plants is more important than the freedoms of people, and consequently dissent has to be stifled. I think the social ramifications in terms of this kind of society we have are perhaps as scary as anything with nuclear power. It also, because of the nature of nuclear power, necessitates large technology, sophisticated kinds of technologies, and consequently would perpetuate a status quo of size and of ruler, of leadership that would that we are already tending towards, and I think in a very negative kind of way. Some people finally have estimated that if we decide to go nuclear power on a large scale, it will take 25% of all investable funds in the United States society. And when you put that kind of money into things, you're not putting it into other things. Finally, perhaps the most immediate drawback to nuclear power is the political one. It's just not acceptable to large numbers of people. In a sense, it has an analog to the abortion issue last night, trying to get abortion pro-life position enacted into law would be very difficult today. And in the same token, a massive commitment to nuclear power would draw a lot of resistance, and consequently politicians are a little reluctant to invest and to make a commitment of the scale that we're talking about for the future. So that's pretty much on nuclear. Is there any questions on nuclear?
I never thought a lot about long-term stability before, but that is, I mean, if all the rest were solved, that still would have, that's just a horrendous problem.
They have a nuclear...
You could not have a dissenting society. You couldn't have people arguing back and forth. You've got to keep it calm. And that means that the Bill of Rights and a few other things would have to be called into question.
That and the big, it's a big technology again.
Yeah.
The question of appropriateness is a very important one there. Yeah, there is a reactor in Iraq, for example. I don't think it's in operation yet, but it's being built. You know, you have an Iranian-Iraqi war, and if they're willing to go after each other's oil facilities, I would suspect that in an extremist, they'll be willing to go after each other's nuclear reactors, too. That's scary. I suggest in this that a policy should be one of minimization. Again, I think that the provision of basic human needs, and I've tried to define that carefully, is the paramount consideration in all this. And if that means nuclear at some point, then I'm quite willing to go with nuclear. But I think we should minimize nuclear and try other avenues first, and that we should have nuclear only after the social commitment has been to conservation and solar power and other renewable sources of energy. And if we decide we need nuclear after that, only with strict environmental and human safeguards and adequate storage of waste.